WMFO Medford. Unlike milk, long-distance telephone calls, and library books, there's no due date, tolls, or expiration in the grand hour. Good morning. It's the 2nd of February, 2022. My name is Arthur, and this morning, because sometimes it's called Tufts Educational Radio, I have a new record I purchased, something from a collection, the Cademan collections that I've been collecting over the years about spoken word poets. Cademan Records was conceived by Barbara Holdridge and Marianne Roney in 1952. They wrote a letter. I don't know if the Welsh poet Dylan Thomas was living in New York or going to visit New York. But either way, they wrote him a letter asking him if he wanted to, in like 1951, they did this at some point, asking him if he wouldn't mind recording some poems for them. Turned out he did. It was kind of impromptu, from what I understand. They recorded it on the 22nd of February, 1952. By all indications, this recording, I've seen the word seed used, inception used, started what we know as audiobooks. So I'm going to go ahead and play side two. This Cademan record, Dylan Thomas, reading selections from his writings. The album I got is actually the 7th edition. So, hope you enjoy. Thanks.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good men the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight, and learn too late they grieved it on its way. Do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death who see with blinding sight, blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Through throats where many rivers meet, the curlews cry. Under the conceiving moon on the high chalk hill. And there this night I walk in the white giant's thigh, where barren as boulders women lie longing still to labor and love, though they lay down long ago. Through throats where many rivers meet, the women pray, pleading in the waded bay for the seed to flow, though the names on their weed-grown stones are rained away. And alone in the night's eternal curving act, they yearn with tongues of curlews for the unconceived and immemorial sons of the cudgeling hacked hill. who once in gooseskin winter loved all ice, lived in the cotter's lanes, or twined in the ox roasting sun, in the wains tunned so high that the wisps of the hay clung to the pitching clouds, or gay with anyone young as they in the after milking moonlight lay under the lighted shapes of faith and their moonshade petticoats galed high, or shy with the rough riding boys. Now clasp me to their grains in the gigantic glade, who once green country since were a hedgerow of joys. Time by, their dust was flesh, the swineherd rooted sly, flared in the reek of the wiving sty with the rushlight of his thighs, spread eagle to the dunghill sky. Or with their orchard men in the core of the sun's bush, rough as cows' tongues and threshed with brambles their buttermilk manes, under his quenchless summer, barbed gold to the bone, or rippling soft in the spinny moon, as the silk and duct and draked white lake that harps to a hailstone. Who once were a bloom of wayside brides in the hoard house, and heard the lewd wood field flow to the coming frost, the scurrying furred small friars squeal in the dows of day, in the thistle aisles, till the white owl crossed their breast, the vaulting does royster, the horned bucks climb quick in the wood at love, where a torch of foxes foams. All birds and beasts of the linked night uproar and chime, and the mole snout blunt under his pilgrimage of domes. Or butterfat goosegirls bounced in a gambo bed, their breasts full of honey, under their gander king trounced by his wings in the hissing shippen. Long dead and gone that barley duck, where their clogs danced in the spring, and their firefly hairpins flew, and the ricks ran round, but nothing bore. No mouthing babe to the veined hives hugged, and barren and bare on Mother Goose's ground, they with the simple jacks were a boulder of wives. Now curlew cry me down to kiss the mouths of their dust. The dust of their kettles and clocks swings to and fro, where the hay rides now, or the bracken kitchens rust, as the arc of the billhooks that flashed the hedges low and cut the birds' boughs that the minstrel sap ran red. They from houses where the harvest bows hold me hard, who heard the tall bell sail down the Sundays of the dead and the rain ring out its tongues on the faded yard. Teach me the love that is evergreen after the fall-leaved grave, after beloved on the grass-gulfed cross is scrubbed off by the sun, and daughters no longer grieved, save by their long desirers in the fox-cubbed streets, or hungering in the crumbled wood. To these hail dead and deathless do the women of the hill, love forever meridian through the quarter's trees, and the daughters of darkness flame like fox fires still. The boughs glided down, and the coast, blackened with birds, took a last look at his threshing hair and whale-blue eye. The trodden town rang its cobbles for luck. Then goodbye to the fisherman boat with its anchor free and fast as a bird hooking over the sea, high and dry by the top of the mast, whispered the affectionate sand and the bulwarks of the dazzled quay. For my sake sail and never look back, said the looking land. Sails drank the wind and white as milk, he sped into the drinking dark. The sun shipwrecked west on a pearl, and the moon swam out of its hulk. Funnels and masts went by in a whirl. Goodbye to the man on the sea-legged deck, to the gold gut that sings on his reel, to the bait that stalked out of the sack. For we saw him throw to the swift flood a girl alive with his hooks through her lips. All the fishes were rayed in blood, said the dwindling ships. Goodbye to chimneys and funnels, old wives that spin in the smoke. He was blind to the eyes of candles in the praying windows of waves, but heard his bait buck in the wake and tussle in a shoal of loves. Now cast down your rod, for the whole of the sea is hilly with whales. She longs among horses and angels. The rainbow fish bend in her joys. Floated the lost cathedral, chimes of the rocked boys. Where the anchor rode like a gull, miles over the moonstruck boat, a squall of birds bellowed and fell. A cloud blew the rain from its throat. He saw the storm smoke out to kill with fuming bows and ram of ice, fire on starlight, rake Jesus' stream. And nothing shone on the water's face but the oil and bubble of the moon, plunging and piercing in his course, the lured fish under the foam, witnessed with a kiss. Whales in the wake like capes and alps quaked the sick sea and snouted deep. Deep the great bushed bait with raining lips slipped the fins of those humpbacked tons and fled their love in a weaving dip. Oh, Jericho was falling in their lungs. She nipped and dived in the nick of love, spun on a spout like a long-legged ball, till every beast blared down in a swerve, till every turtle crushed from his shell, till every bone in the scuttled grave rose and crowed and fell. Good luck to the hen on the rod. There is thunder under its thumbs. Gold gut is a lightning thread. His fiery reel sings off its flames. The world boat in the burn of his blood is crying from nets to knives. Oh, the Shearwater birds and their boat-sized brood. Oh, the bulls of Biscay and their calves are making under the green laid veil the long-legged beautiful bait their wives. Break the black news and paint on a sail huge weddings in the waves. Over the wakeward flashing spray, over the gardens of the floor, clash out the mounting dolphin's day. My mast is a bell spire. Strike and smooth, for my decks are drums. Sing through the water-spoken prow, the octopus walking into her limbs, the polar eagle with his tread of snow. From salt-lipped beak to the kick of the stern, sing how the seal has kissed her dead. The long-laid minute's bride drifts on, old in her cruel bed. Over the graveyard in the water, mountains and galleries beneath, nightingale and hyena rejoicing for their drifting death, sing and howl through sand and anemone, valley and Sahara in a shell. Oh, all the wanting flesh's enemy, thrown to the sea in the shell of a girl, is old as water and plain as an eel. Always goodbye to the long-legged bread scattered in the paths of his heels, for the salty birds fluttered and fed and the tall grains foamed in their bills. Always goodbye to the fires of the face, for the crab-backed dead on the seabed rose and scuttled over her eyes. The blind clawed stare is cold as sleet. The tempter under the eyelid, who shows to the selves asleep mast-high moon-white women naked, walking in wishes and lovely for shame, is dumb and gone with his flame of brides. Susanna's drowned in the bearded stream, and no one stirs at Sheba's side but the hungry kings of the tide. Sin, who had a woman's shape, sleep still silence blows on a cloud, and all the lifted waters walk and leap. Lucifer, that bird's dropping out of the sides of the north, has melted away and is lost, is always lost in her vaulted breath. Venus lies starstruck in her wound, and the sensual ruins make seasons over the liquid world white. Springs in the dark. Always goodbye, cried the voices through the shell. Goodbye always, for the flesh is cast, and the fisherman winds his reel with no more desire than a ghost. Always good luck, praised the fin in the feather bird after dark, and the laughing fish, as the sails drank up the hail of thunder, and the long-tailed lightning lit his cat. The boat swims into the six-year weather. A wind throws a shadow and it freezes fast. See what the gold gut drags from under mountains and galleries to the crest. See what clings to hair and skull as the boat skims on with drinking wings. The statues of great rain stand still and the flakes fall like hills. Sing and strike his heavy haul, toppling up the boatside in a snow of light. His decks are drenched with miracles. Oh, miracle of fishes, the long dead bite. Out of the urn, the size of a man, out of the room, the weight of his trouble, out of the house that holds a town in the continent of a fossil, one by one in dust and shawl, dry as echoes and insect-faced, his fathers cling to the hand of the girl, and the dead hand leads the past. Leads them as children and as heir onto the blindly tossing top. The centuries throw back their hair, and the old men sing from newborn lips. Time is bearing another son. Kill time, she turns in her pain. The oak is felled in the acorn, and the hawk in the egg kills the wren. He who blew the great fire in and died on a hiss of flames, or walked on the earth in the evening, counting the denials of the grains, clings to her drifting hair and climbs. And he who taught their lips to sing weeps like the risen sun among the liquid choirs of his tribes. The rod bends low, divining land, and through the sundered water crawls a garden holding to her hand with birds and animals, with men and women and waterfalls, trees cool and dry in the whirlpool of ships. And stunned and still on the green laid veil, sand with legends in its virgin laps, and prophets loud on the burned dune. Insects and valleys hold her thighs hard. Times and places grip her breastbone. She is breaking with seasons and clouds. Round her trailed wrist fresh water weaves, with moving fish and rounded stones, up and down the greater waves. A separate river breathes and runs. Strike and sing his catch of fields, for the surge is sown with barley. The cattle graze on the covered foam. The hills have footed the waves away with wild sea fillies and soaking bridles, with salty colts and gales in their limbs. All the horses of his hall of miracles gallop through the arched green farms, trot and gallop with gulls upon them and thunderbolts in their manes. O Rome and Sodom, tomorrow and London, the country tide is cobbled with towns, and steeples pierce the cloud on her shoulder, and the streets that the fisherman combed when his long-legged flesh was a wind on fire and his loin was a hunting flame, coil from the thoroughfares of her hair and terribly lead him home alive. Lead her prodigal home to his terror, the furious ox-killing house of love. Down, 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 under the ground, under the floating villages, turns the moon-chained and water-wound metropolis of fishes. There is nothing left of the sea but its sound. Under the earth the loud sea walks. In deathbeds of orchards the boat dies down, and the bait is drowned among hayricks. Land, 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 nothing remains of the pacing famous sea but its speech, and into its talkative seven tombs the anchor dives through the floors of a church. Goodbye, good luck, struck the sun and the moon to the fisherman lost on the land. He stands alone at the door of his home with his long-legged heart in his hand. Myself, the grievers, grieve. Among the street burned to tireless death, a child of a few hours with its kneading mouth charred on the black breast of the grave the mother dug and its arms full of fires. Begin with singing, sing, darkness kindled back into beginning when the court tongue nodded blind. A star was broken into the centuries of the child. Myself grieve now, and miracles cannot atone. Forgive us your death, that myself, the believers, may hold it in a great flood till the blood shall spurt. And the dust shall sing like a bird as the grains blow, as your death grows through our heart. Crying your dying cry, child beyond cockcrow, by the fire-dwarfed street we chant the flying sea in the body bereft. Love is the last light spoken. O seed of suns in the loin of the black husk left. I know not whether Adam or Eve, the adorned holy bullock, or the white ewe lamb, or the chosen virgin laid in her snow on the altar of London, was the first to die in the cinder of the little skull. O bride and bridegroom, O Adam and Eve together, lying in the lull under the sad breast of the headstone, white as the skeleton of the Garden of Eden. I know the legend of Adam and Eve is never for a second silent in my service over the dead infants, over the one child who was priest and servants, word, singers, and tongue in the cinder of the little skull. Who was the serpent, nightfall, and the fruit like a sun, man and woman undone, beginning crumbled back to darkness, bare as the nurseries of the Garden of Wilderness. Into the organ pipes and steeples of the luminous cathedrals, into the weathercock's molten mouths, rippling in 12-winded circles, into the dead clock burning the hour over the urn of Sabbaths, over the whirling ditch of daybreak, over the sun's hovel and the slum of fire, and the golden pavements laid in requiems. Into the bread in a wheat field of flames, into the wine burning like brandy, the messes of the sea, the messes of the sea under, the messes of the infant bearing sea. Erupt, fountain, and enter to utter forever glory, glory, glory. The sundering ultimate kingdom of Genesis thunder.
Wake up and text. Text and eat. Mm-mm. Text and catch the bus. Text and miss your stop.
Wait.
Text and be late to work.
Sorry, I'm late.
Text and work. Text and pretend to work. Text and act surprised when someone calls you out for not working.
Who, me?
Text and meet up with a friend you haven't seen in forever.
Hi.
Oh, hey.
Text and complain that they're on their phone the whole time. Text and listen to them complain that you're on your phone the whole time. Text and whatever. But when you get behind the wheel, give your phone to a passenger. Put it in the glove box. Just don't text and drive. Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
All right. Yeah, that one's titled Text and Whatever. Preceded by that was my notes. What was considered the first recordings for an audiobook, Caedmon recordings, that was volume one. The Welsh poet Dylan Thomas recorded on the 22nd of February 1952 in New York. Again, Caedmon Records was conceived by Barbara Holdridge and Marianne Aroney. They wrote a letter to either the visiting or in residence in New York poet and asked him if he would read so they could record it. They went on to, I don't know how many recordings they ended up doing. They did several, I know I have several in my collection. And it was later bought by HarperCollins. Still available, most of them are. And the newer formats. Downloads. My name is Arthur, and you're listening to The Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org, Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. For the second half of the show, we're going to honor Black History Month with a Destination Freedom. This one is titled The Boy Who Was Traded for a Horse. It had an original air date of the 17th of October, 1948. Destination Freedom was created and written by Richard Durham and was broadcast from the 27th of June 1948 to the 13th of August 1950 on WMAQ in Chicago. The Boy Who Was Traded for a Horse is this is a story about George Washington Carver. Thanks for listening.
Destination Freedom. The Chicago Defender and Station WMAQ bring you Destination Freedom, dramatizations of the great democratic traditions of the Negro people, interwoven in the pageant of history and a part of America's own Destination Freedom. Today, Destination Freedom tells the story of the famous scientist Dr. George Washington Carver in a chapter entitled The Boy Who Was Traded for a Horse.
They never let him forget the horse. He was to remember the horse long after he'd forgotten his father and mother. For in a way, the horse was to set him free, if he were worth the horse. That was the question. Was one skinny, sickly little boy worth Farmer Carver's dirty stallion? That was the question the slave stealers had stopped in a Missouri valley to decide.
Is this all you got, Farmer? A horse? Ain't you got no money?
All I got's my horse. Ain't that enough?
Hey, it don't look like a good trade, Tom. If you ask me...
Who's asking you, Slim? The farmer's putting it up to me. The boy and his mother's mine, not yours. Now be quiet a minute.
Oh, all right, Tom. All right. You settle it.
Farmer?
Yeah?
Open your horse's mouth. Let's see his teeth.
Whoa, Peter. Whoa. There. Well?
And teeth look all right. Give him a whack, Slim. Turn him around. Oh.
No knots on his legs. But, Tom, a slave boy will fetch a right good price in Louisiana. Won't he, Jackson?
Sure he will, Tom. They're dying for slaves down in Louisiana.
Sure.
Will you keep quiet? Farmer, you've been following us since we took the boy and his mother from his master. Now, what's he to you?
It's my wife that wants them set free at any price.
And where's the price?
I'm just a cotton farmer. I don't have no money.
Slim?
Yeah, Tom?
What do you think?
Well, a horse ain't bad, ain't too old. But you being short-sighted, Tom.
Yeah, Tom, in 10 years, the horse won't be worth nothing. Boy, he'll get more valuable as he grows. Then in 10 years...
In 10 months, you fool, the war will be open, the slaves will be free. Won't be able to sell them nowhere. We need another horse. Farmer?
Yeah?
Tie the horse to that tree there and go down the road a piece while we examine him good. Come back when the sun sets. You'll either have the boy or the horse.
What about his mother?
The horse might be worth a boy. Ain't no horse worth a woman and a boy. Now go down the road and we'll call you when we decide.
How'll I know you won't run off and take them both?
You don't. We could take them both if we wanted them both. Maybe we don't want them both. Come back in a little while and you'll have either the boy or your horse. Well, what you standing there for?
The farmer went down the road, and when the sun set and the purple shadows crept over the valley, he came back toward the tree. He heard a horse galloping away. His horse was gone. The boy was there, small, thin, sick and shivering. Farmer Carver was disappointed.
Is this what I gave my horse for? Well, don't lay there. Straighten yourself out, boy. You look like a question mark. At least live long enough so my old woman will know I did what she said. Lord, where'll I get another horse?
Was the boy worth the horse? To Farmer Carver, it was a bad bargain. To his old woman, it was different.
Martha! Martha!
Yeah? Moses?
Well, they took the horse, but I got the boy for you.
Where's Mary? You didn't bring Mary.
The boy was all I could get. He won't live. He's sick.
He's got to live. Oh, thank the Lord, Moses. Mary's boy's still alive. He's trembling, and the cold's tearing his little body to pieces. Oh, those miserable slave stealers. Get the doctor.
And pay him with what? Answer me, woman. What'll we pay the doctor with? The bugs and the boll weevils eating us out of house and home, and now we got a Negro boy to contend with.
He's Mary's child, and Mary was my best friend. She always helped us any way she could. Now, I'll nurse her boy until he's well again.
Yeah, then what'll we do with him?
He'll stay here and live on the farm. He'll be a carver, like us. I'll call him George. George Carver.
George. That horse would have helped plow the cotton crop. We live off the cotton. The boy'll never live to hear you call his name.
What on earth is that boy? Moses, will you stop eating a minute and tell me?
Where he always spends his time. Out in the woods, picking up weeds and worms. I told you we should have kept that horse. Pass the butter.
Now you know George has helped us a plenty around the farm since he's been here. You said so yourself.
I've said he's growing up strange. Don't like it.
He's a good boy. And you mustn't be so hard on him all the time.
10 years, and I'm no closer to him than on that first day. He's always a planting something. Ain't there enough cotton for him to plant without him planting every weed he sees?
He's lonely.
Yeah, he's crazy. The neighbors say so. They hear him always talking to the flowers and turtles like he was one of them.
Oh, George! George!
And the questions he asks. He ain't normal. When I was a boy, I didn't give a hang what makes grasshoppers hop and what makes grass green. And the way he loves flowers, it ain't natural. Biscuits, please.
He does have a feeling for anything that grows. It's time we sent him to a town where there's a high school. That's what he wants.
I'll not waste my money on him. More butter, Marta.
George? Oh, here he comes.
I'm coming, Mama. I'm coming.
Well, what you got in your pockets? You're all puffed out. Where you been?
I've been out in the woods.
What did I tell you?
Here, clean up and get your supper. What's that you're holding behind you? Let's see it.
Oh, it's just an old turtle I picked up in the creek. Why does a turtle always...
You say? Questions. There he goes again.
What's this in your back pocket, George? Oh, let's see.
That's moss. It grows on the north side of the trees.
What's in your pockets besides the bird's nest and those flowers and that rock?
It's a frog I found.
Oh.
Come here, Jumpy.
Get him off the supper table, George.
Will you get him down from here? Take that frog out of here. You see there? See what you've done? Now get out of here.
Don't talk to him like that, Moses.
I'll talk the way I feel. Since the boy's been here, we've had nothing but trouble. And I've had enough.
Blame it on the cotton crops. Don't blame it on the boy.
The crops was all right until we traded the horse for this daydreaming boy. I wish I'd kept the horse.
Moses, you had no right to say that to the boy. George, why do you look that way? Moses don't mean half, he says. George, sit down and eat.
I'm not hungry.
The boy was hearing the horse gallop off, and he was not hungry.
I'm not hungry now. I want to go to the school you were telling me about.
Well, we can talk about that in the morning.
In the morning. I'll be a long way from here. A long way.
With Martha's kind help, the boy packed his knapsack, stuffed his pockets with seeds and leaves, and walked the 60 miles to Boomtown. Sat in a classroom by day and slept in a woodshed behind a Negro blacksmith's house. Until the owner came in one night to stack the wood.
Who's in here? I see you in the shadows there.
John, help! Somebody's in here!
It's just me, ma'am.
You? Who are you? Whose boy are you?
Nobody's. I'm George Carver.
Every boy is somebody's boy. What are you doing in my woodshed?
I live here.
You're a mean little thief.
John, you hear me? Call the law.
Please, I'm not a thief. I go to school.
You'll go to jail and the devil for this. That's where you'll go. What will the likes of you be learning in school?
To learn how to make things.
What things?
Oh, John, will you come out here?
To make things, ma'am. Look, like this.
What are you pulling out of your pocket?
This. I made this.
You made this? This is a flower.
I mean, I grew it.
Only God can make things grow.
And I learn how from him. If you let me live in the shed while I go to school, will you?
Emma, you call me, you in trouble?
It's all right, John.
All right. Rag him up in the woodshed and you say all right. What's he looking for?
God.
Oh. Well, I'll be frank with both of you. You won't find God in the woodshed on a cold night like this. Now, come on to the house and get some stuff.
The boy who had been traded for a horse came in for supper and stayed 4 years working with the blacksmith. He cooked and scrubbed and learned what the school had to teach him about the soil and the sun. His questions outgrew the town, and the blacksmith John and his wife Emma argued over where to send the orphan.
Emma, I've already decided that George is going north to college. Isn't that right, George?
Yes, I sent my application to Highland College in Emma.
Running north when there's plenty of work to be done right here in the south. What's his education for?
There's nothing he can do here, Emma. Missouri ain't the place for him. All he's putting his head about plants and pollination and stuff's wasted. Yep.
I still say he shouldn't run away.
And what'll his chemistry do for him in the cotton fields? Tell me. And besides, look outside.
I'm looking. Come away from the door, George. The crowd's gathering again.
What is it, Uncle John? Been that way all day. What's the matter?
Negro was lynched in the next county. The fever's still running high. The boy'll not stay here. That college took your application, George. Go north where there ain't no Jim Crow, no discrimination. You got a letter from Mr. Peabody, the president of the college. He welcomed you with open arms.
Yes, I'm President Peabody, but... Carver.
George Washington Carver's name.
Yes. You see, there's been some terrible, terrible mistake.
Your letter said a report to school today.
Yes, but we didn't know you were a Negro. You should have told us.
What's the difference?
The difference is that we don't take Negro students. Never have.
Oh?
I'm sorry. Try some other college.
You're sure you're the young man who applied to enter this college?
Of course, I got your letter, accepted my application.
Let's see the letter.
Here it is.
You wanted to enter what school?
I wanted chemistry.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Our chemistry classes are filled.
But I'd take botany to start off.
That appears to be filled also. In fact, we just don't seem to have any place for you at all, Carver. Try another college.
Very sorry, Carver, but our quota's failed. We just can't accept Negroes and Jews. Sorry.
And the boy was traded back and forth between the colleges. And in his head he heard the clatter of a galloping horse as the colleges weighed the question of whether he was worth admission. Until he quietly entered Iowa State College and buried himself in books and laboratories. But in his pockets, the flowers still grew. And on the campus one day, he was stopped and questioned.
Young man, what's that sticking out of your pocket?
Oh, you mean this plant?
Yes. May I see it?
Certainly.
I used to be an expert on these things. This, I'd say, is a Mencilia ornata.
I didn't know the name of it.
I noticed it because the nearest one grows quite a distance from the college.
I picked it up on my way here.
Well, then you live a long way from the school. No wonder you get here at all. Don't you like living in the dormitories?
You haven't been here long, mister. Negro students are barred from dormitories here.
Oh, I see. Well, then, suppose you move in with me. I live on the campus.
Then they'd kick us both out.
I hardly think so. I'm president of this college. Come on, we'll have dinner and talk this over.
The boy again went to dinner and stayed 4 years to find the answers to his boyhood questions, to work in the field and laboratories, to learn the laws of the microbes and molecules. He had come to learn. He stayed to teach. He took his students out into the field and showed them how to reap and sow. Showed them how to shuffle the molecules and change nature into a dozen different products. The word went around that he could raise corn on a wooden floor, that he was a magician with molecules and test tubes. Then President Wilson had a word with him.
Professor Carver, we've gotten another telegram asking if we'll release you to work at another college.
He had come to learn. He stayed to teach. He took his students out into the field and showed them how to reap and sow. Showed them how to shuffle the molecules and change nature into a dozen different products. The word went around that he could raise corn on a wooden floor. That he was a magician with molecules and test tubes. Then President Wilson had a word with him.
Professor Carver, we've gotten another telegram asking if we'll release you to work at another college. I thought I'd take it up with you.
My answer's the same. Tell them all that this is where I'm staying.
But the requests kept coming in. And one telegram came from the South. It said...
Dr. Carver, we're trying to build a school for Negroes here in Alabama. We need help. Trained scientific help. Signed, Booker T. Washington.
And Carver remembered the clatter of the horse and the barren farm he grew from. And he saw how easily the crops grew in Iowa and threw away the letters until one said,
Dr. Carver, if it's money you need, stay where you are. But if you want work that will test every theory you have, come to Alabama. If you want to work and see what really can be done with soil and sun, leave Iowa. Come to Tuskegee. Come to my office, and we'll plan our fight. I've taught reading and writing. I've taught students how to make good bricks, build walls, and be carpenters.
But nothing will grow here for long. Look out at the land. It's a lot different from Iowa, isn't it, Professor?
Yes, it is, Dr. Washington. Yes, it is.
Carver looked, and as far as the eye could see, there were the bleak stretches of yellow and red soil, erosion gullies, rocks, and a few struggling plants.
It's easy for a chemist to be a genius in a state like Iowa, but can you grow anything out there? Out there are 500,000 black and white farmers, mostly sharecroppers. Some sick, some starving, and they don't know how to farm. That land's all they've got.
Yes, and that land is worn out.
Well, you tell them that. I can't.
Well, I tell them.
We thought you'd start out with a class in farming. Maybe then you can get across the idea of scientific planning. What do you think?
Maybe.
The professor was worried. He looked around for a laboratory and found an empty room. There were no orderly test tubes, no trained assistants, but boys off the farms who gathered around the new teacher and waited. He told them,
Before we go to the farmers, we'll have to build a laboratory here. And we'll search the fields and farmhouses and dump heaps for bottles we can use as test tubes. We'll gather hollow reed from swamps to make tubing. We'll pick up jugs, skillets, saucepans, anything. We'll weld the steel together and make plows. And then we'll go after the land.
They gave him a small plot of land to work on. And the older farmers came by to look and laugh at the sight of a professor behind a plow.
Well, bud, look at the Yankee professor showing us how to plow.
Yeah, look at that.
Hey, professor, you got the horse fixed the wrong way. You ought to be where the horse is.
That's right, man.
The farmers laughed and laughed, but they stopped laughing when they saw the thin, stooped professor planting cowpeas between the furrows.
Well, professor, you didn't come down here and show us about planting cowpeas, did you?
It's cotton we got to plant.
Yeah.
If you can tell us something about cotton, talk.
Go ahead.
If you can, don't waste time calling us out here.
Yes, you're right. It's time I told you what I'm planting.
It's time you found out you're in Alabama, not Iowa. It's cotton we need, not cowpeas.
No, it's cotton I came to talk about. How much did your crops yield last year?
Well, I'd say nigh on 2 bales.
The year before this?
About 6 bales, then.
Yeah.
It's been going down each year. But it's the only cash crop we can raise around here. Ground's not good for nothing else. This ain't Iowa, Professor.
Then you've got the answers to why I'm planting cowpeas in the ground instead of cotton.
Huh?
The ground around here is tired of cotton. It's got to have a rest.
Yeah.
Let it rest this year, and it'll yield double next year.
Oh, we heard that before from you, smart professor.
Yeah,
look, cotton's a money crop.
Cotton will bring cash. There's not enough money now to buy food to keep a man's kids from dying before his eyes with plague.
Got it.
He's talking crazy.
I'm talking to help you. Now, trust me. Forget about planting cotton and let the land rest with another crop. Do that, and I'll find a way to help stop plague.
Yeah,
smart professor. How?
Bring me all the different weeds and shrubs that grow around you. Even the ones that you say are poison. I'll show you which ones you can eat to stop pellagra.
And the farmers brought piles of weeds to the professor's laboratory. And he came out with the weeds cooked and put them before the farmers.
Now,
right around your homes, in the yards, there's weeds you can eat that will stop plague. Try them. They're good.
They're weed poison, Professor. Everybody knows that.
Now, the ones I've selected are not poison, if cooked this way. Now, look. I'll eat them for you. And if I live, will you rotate your crops?
The farmers watched the professor eat the weeds, then took his recipe and turned away from cotton for a year. And the next year, when the new cotton started growing, the counties of Alabama had an early celebration for the great crops. Professor Washington came into Professor Carver's laboratory.
Carver, you done it.
What's that?
What's that? Man, get away from the test tubes for a while and look about the country. It's the greatest cotton crop in Alabama's history.
Yes, but I don't like it.
What are you talking about?
Cotton is a cash crop, ruled in the South with an iron fist. He who owns the cotton owns the people who work it. I came back here because I know the land has got to grow more than cotton if the people are to be free.
I see. And what do you have in mind?
I don't know yet. I've been working on some experiments trying to find a way out.
You've done enough. Your formula for turning mud into paint's been picked up by the Agriculture Department. Alabama mud's the most popular mud in the world.
And Alabama poverty is the worst in the world. Until we can grow something besides cotton, you're doomed.
Well, have you any ideas what ought to be planted?
I have plenty of ideas. I just don't have any ideas on how to get rid of the cotton.
The professor walked home from his laboratory and saw the cotton ready to burst into bolls for the biggest crop. But that morning, a farmer had even bigger news.
Professor Carver! Carver!
Yes, what is it?
Look, I found one in the cotton patch this morning.
I can't see it. What is it?
The boll weevil.
Oh.
Where there's one, there's a billion. What'll we do?
Well, there's nothing to do but plow under the cotton and plant another crop.
What crops is there the boll weevil can't get at?
You call the farmers together with my garden. I'll tell them.
The farmers for 100 miles gathered around the professor's little garden and saw him lift a familiar vine.
Here's a sweet potato and a peanut vine untouched by the boll weevil. Next to it was the cotton. The boll weevil ate it. Now I say again, plow under your cotton, plant sweet potatoes and peanuts.
Well, I don't know much about this peanut crop, but what can we lose? Boll weevil's got cotton.
I'd stake everything on the crops he's talking about. I'm willing.
Me too.
Well, what can we lose?
Yeah, I'll go along. I'm
agreeing.
The professor won the first round. The farmers plowed under their cotton, sprinkled the ground with poison, and planted peanuts and sweet potatoes. And when the crops came up, the leafy vines stretched across the state. And the farmers came around. They had a few polite questions.
The peanut crop's planted and grown well, Professor.
It'll be the biggest peanut crop the country's known, some say.
I was wondering what'll we do with them when they're ready to be picked.
Peanuts and potatoes are food. You could find a market for them.
I wonder.
Professor Carver went back to his laboratory to reshuffle the molecules of the peanut and potato. But the crops were almost ready to harvest, and some were rotting in the field. Panic swept over the farms, and the farmers came over to visit the professor at his home. They threw open the door.
There he is. There's a Yankee professor told us to plant peanuts.
Come on, Professor. We want to talk to you.
Come on here.
What do you want here? What have I done to you?
You've made us sink everything we had in the fool's crop. Now the fields will rot with them.
Nobody wants to buy peanuts, Professor.
Oh, let him alone. Ain't his fault. Too many peanuts on the market already.
We took his advice and planted them.
Let's give them back to him.
Wait. I tell you, you did right by planting peanuts. And there's not enough on the market.
Don't tell us. You tell the guys who buy them.
Thanks to you, we raised enough peanuts to supply a circus for 10 years.
Look, farmer, there is more use for your crops than for circuses, for pleasure. I'm working on ways to use them. In a few more days, I'll have something that'll make them buy out all your crops. Give me a little more time.
Time? I read where they're even planning to admit foreign-grown peanuts into the country tax-free.
More peanuts than anybody ever used. Give them to him, boy.
Let me go back to my laboratory and finish the experiments. I'll have something to make you proud of what you planted.
Well, here's some you can have to work on. Hold up them bushels of peanuts,
yeah,
boys.
Yeah, yeah.
Dump them on them.
Yeah.
When the farmers had gone, the professor picked up the peanuts, took them to his laboratory, gave orders that no one was to come in. And for 6 days and nights, they watched the light burn while he stripped down the peanut, took it to pieces, and began to rebuild. On the seventh day, he staggered out of the laboratory.
Carver, are you all right?
Very well. Tell the farmers not to destroy the crop. Let me rest and wake me Monday. I am going to Washington.
Professor Carver slept, and when he woke, filled his satchel with jars and tubes from his laboratory, and went on his way to Washington to place the case of the peanut before the Senate committee in a crowded hearing room.
Has the last witness been heard? Is it agreed that peanuts will be excluded from the tariff bill, then? If so, we'll proceed.
Just a minute, Mr. Chairman. One more witness from Tuskegee Institute. Dr. George Washington Carver.
Oh, another witness? What can he say that hasn't already been said?
If you will listen to him for 5 minutes, Mr. Chairman, there are some manufacturers in the house who would like to hear him.
The chair will recognize Dr. George Washington Carver for 5 minutes. Can you cover your subject in 5 minutes, Dr. Carver?
No, but I can make a start.
What are you here for? To testify for or against the tariff on peanuts?
Oh, I'm not interested in tariffs, gentlemen. I was told the Senate wanted to know if it were worth the while to support the peanut crops in the South. Now, if you'll wait until I lift my suitcase to the table and open it, I'll present you with the peanut. First here, made from the peanut, are some inexpensive insulating boards. This is synthetic coffee. Paper, flour, milk and cheese, plastics, stains, creams, powder, buttermilk, mucilage, ink, starch, tapioca.
Professor Carver pulled out of his bag 300 synthetics made from the Alabama peanuts. The senators listened. The manufacturers rushed home to order the southern crops. The boy, who had been traded for a horse, put the peanuts back into his bag and went to his laboratory to reshuffle the molecules. The sound of the horse still clear in his head.
You have just heard Destination Freedom's dramatization of the story of Dr. George Washington Carver. It is brought to you by the Chicago Defender newspaper and station WMAQ. Destination Freedom is written by Richard Durham and produced under the direction of Homer Heck. The role of George Washington Carver was played by Fred Pinker. Others were Hope Summers, Gladys Williams, Oscar Brown, Ken Griffin, George Kluge, and Arthur Peterson. The special music was written by Emil Soderstrom and played by Elwin Owen and Bobby Christian. This is Hugh Downs inviting you to be with us again next week at this same time. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
Actually, not in D.C., but that was the actual Hugh Downs from the 70s and 80s. He had 2020, he was on 2020, I believe. My name is Arthur, and you've been listening to the Grand Hour here at 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org, Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. in celebration of Black History Month. That was the All-Negro Ensemble, Destination Freedom. The only one of its kind there for a long time. After it went off the air in 1950, it continued from 1951 to 1952. However, it didn't really reach out. It didn't really stay true to the form that Richard Durham had wanted. More of a, more of a slapstick type deal, I think, perhaps. Yeah, this one repeats. That's awesome. Again, thanks for listening.